This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up, filmmaker Mike Friedman says we've hit critical mass towards extinction by overpopulation. Bill McKibben tells me why everybody in the world needs to battle the tar sands. Council of Canada's founder Maude Barlow links dirty energy to dirty politics. And Native leader Caleb Benn on his fracked land, poisoned lives, and linking up around the world. I'm Alex Smith with a full show. Let's get going.
Back in the 1950s, we heard about some experiments done by a man called Cahoon, in which he put rats into a limited space and then gave them unlimited resources. The rat population started to grow. It reached a point where they could no longer function as rats. Their social structure collapsed. The population was in serious trouble.
To make a bomb, you need critical mass. In the nuclear world, critical mass is the amount of radioactive material required in just the right shape to create a self-sustaining chain reaction and maybe a devastating explosion. Millions of people around the world are wondering if we're heading towards that moment. Filmmaker Mike Friedman set out to document the really big picture, the forces that could culminate in disaster for humanity and most living things. Mike, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
Well, you have an earlier short documentary up on Vimeo called Between Two Mirrors, Occupy London. Tell us about that.
Well, while I was in production on Critical Mass, I had a friend staying with me from Australia, Sharon Ead, who also helped us with the interviews on the long doc. And we decided to go down and check out the first day of the Occupy protest in London. I have a little GoPro camera that you can mount on your head. And to my amazement, with the camera mounted on my head, I could just walk around filming. And no one seemed to notice, really, that I was wearing a camera. So I went down, I spoke to some of the police, I spoke to some of the protesters, and then with about 40 minutes of footage, I just chopped it up into a little 8-minute thing that I felt was good enough to make available. In terms of why I chose that name and why I feel that that little 8-minute thing is worth watching, I was struck by the complicity of the protesters in their own enclosure. As I say briefly in that short documentary, there's an element of consent in a protest like that, where the ring of police surrounding the protesters isn't big enough or strong enough to really hold them. So there's a kind of consent to accept the authority that's imposed. And a few people have criticized the police in the UK, and similar allegations have been made against other police forces around the world, of undue brutality in putting down ideological protests like the Occupy movement. And to me, I wanted to make a point that the police at that protest were suffering from exactly the consequences of the perfidy that Occupy were protesting against. And in fact, there's a police officer who says quite clearly that, you know, it's his job to keep the protesters in, whether or not he agrees with them. And the Metropolitan Police Force that were keeping them enclosed were suffering massive, stringent cuts across the board, especially to frontline policing and backroom staff. And so, obviously, there was a sympathy there. And it struck me, and I elaborated on it in an open letter to the Occupy movement that I posted on my blog on the website, which was that we're in a time now, socially speaking, that there are no good and bad people anymore. There's simply people who know what's going on and people who've been misinformed. There's a verse in the Tao, which I used to conclude that short documentary, which is, what is a good man but a bad man's teacher? What is a bad man but a good man's job? And I find it very striking that in what we call the information age, the dividing line in most social or political conflicts is drawn by access to the right information. And so it seemed to me that the protesters were one mirror of our culture, and the police were another. The police would just as easily be facing outwards protecting them if the rules changed ever so slightly, because the police force is a tool, not a weapon. Its deadliness or its passivity is dictated by the hand that wields it. And so I felt that I was between two mirrors, as in both of them essentially neutral, simply reflecting what they were being told on the one hand, people being told that their futures were going to be bleaker, that we were giving money to the banks that could be better used for social programs, that social programs had to be cut because of quote-unquote necessity. And on the other hand, a mirror showing us that the establishment doesn't respond well to ideological criticism. Time again, you see that plenty of space is given to protests against single issues or protests in favor of a whole wealth of things. But when there really is a resistance and a crackdown from the establishment, it tends to be something like the Occupy movement, which has at its core not an activity, but an ideal. And this always seems very threatening. So that was why I called it Between Two Mirrors. And that was the thinking that led me to put it up on the web for free, in the hope that people would watch it and share it.
Well, we should backtrack then, because you were already on your adventure to grab the big picture, the whole ball of wax. What started you out on that?
Being a filmmaker, I watch a lot of films. You know, if you want to be a writer, you have to read. If you want to make films, you have to watch them. And I'm a big fan of documentary, especially environmental documentary. And I noticed a trend in environmental films that were otherwise well-researched and perfectly competently constructed, that they tended to stop short or skirt around the issue of population. They would discuss the depletion of a resource or the destruction of a natural environment. And if they did mention the role of people in that depletion or destruction, it was usually couched as a consumption issue, as if consumption was the only issue. And it seemed to me that that was either an oversight or disingenuous, or, to give them the credit that they rightly deserve, simply that it's too big of a subject to be tackled as an aside in a documentary focusing on something else. And so my motive for making Critical Mass was that I believe very strongly that the number of humans alive on the planet and the way that number changes the way we think and feel and behave has an intimate relationship with the other environmental crises we see around us, and also itself an intimate relationship with the manner in which and the amount that we consume. And so, wanting to frame that properly in a film, I set out to begin my research. But I didn't want to make a Malthusian dirge telling everyone that people were bad for the planet and that all consumption is terrible and that, you know, there should be less people. That's not what I believe, and it's not what I was hoping to achieve. My goal was to basically recount the human story in a hope that it would point to a deeper understanding of where we stood now.
Well, of course, we got to talk about John Calhoun's rat experiment, which is in your movie trailer for Critical Mass. Talk to us about that. What was he trying to do? Why did he do it? And what does it tell us?
Well, that's exactly the right point to ask that question, Alex, so I thank you. Basically, I came across Calhoun's experiments in my preliminary reading. And once I knew about those experiments, I had my narrative. I had my story that I could tell. And then from that story, on that spine, if you like, I could hang the parallels to the human situation, which is the way that we made the film. Calhoun himself was a, depending on which job title you use, the most common is a research psychologist at the National Institute of Mental Health, which itself is very interesting because Calhoun only ever worked with rodents. And so it was very telling that in his early career, he was transferred from, I believe it was Walter Reed, to the National Institute of Mental Health, which deals explicitly with mental health for people. So there was always implied within his work and made explicit by him several times a parallel to human behavior, human society. The way that Calhoun conducted his experiments was very simple. He would construct an enclosure that contained all the necessary food, water, and nesting material for survival. He would place breeding pairs, so male and female rodents, into those enclosures, and he would simply allow them to roam around this Garden of Eden. And slowly they would begin to reproduce, and that reproduction would accelerate. And as this trend continued, he charted the progress of the population's growth and the manner in which the rats' behavior changed over time, both of which bear striking parallels to human behavior and human society as it's developed. It's also worth noting that in terms of knowing what rats were like, Calhoun literally wrote the book on the Norway rat. He wrote a book called The Ecology of the Norway Rat. So this was a man who was intimately acquainted with the behavior of this species in the wild. And so he was uniquely placed to discuss and investigate the way that that species' behavior changed when transplanted from its natural setting to an enclosure that he himself referred to as Rat City. He believed that he was replicating conditions for the rats that we see in human urban environments. And so his work was always meant to be understood as a way, a lens of viewing ourselves and our urban environments and the way in which we interact with one another and how that has changed, how it may change, and how we can preserve those very special and unique bonds that we consider valuable in human society.
But, Mike, is the rat experiment really a good model to predict what will happen to humans on an expanding, expanding on a finite planet? Aren't we more intelligent?
Well, I'll leave the question as to whether we're more intelligent than rats to one side for a moment. I want to make something absolutely clear, which is that I'm not suggesting, and nor did Calhoun suggest, that what the rats did, so shall we do. That is not what he meant. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that all mammals, like rodents and humans, have behavior patterns, some of which are genetic, some of which are learned, some of which are simple, some of which are complex. And those behavior patterns change depending on the social conditions in which we live. Now, it's not to say that what a rat does in an enclosure, a human will do in a city. It is, however, worth considering that there are structural similarities. So rats have a type of society. Humans have a type of society. Rats have certain behaviors. Humans have certain behaviors. And within a dense, stressful, crowded, impersonal milieu, the rats suffered, and I don't necessarily believe it needs to be argued that humans also suffer in dense, stressed, crowded, impersonal milieu. So the parallel is not meant to be direct. It is meant to be, in essence, as I said before, a lens or a metaphor for what we're going through and what we may continue to go through. As for humans being more intelligent, towards the end of the film, I offer an observation, which is that, and I believe this is verbatim because I had to memorize it to record it in the voiceover booth, humans might not be rats, but that doesn't mean we can't learn from what happened to them. It means we have to do better.
The assumptions that 9 billion people on the planet by 2050 would not be a problem are generally predicated on the assumption that we can continue to increase agricultural yields. And the way agricultural yields have been increased over the past 100 years is because pesticides that are made from oil and herbicides that are made from oil and natural gas that makes the fertilizer and the oil that makes the tractors run and the trucks run, that will all continue to be available in the quantities and at the prices that it's available today. And that won't necessarily be the case. It almost certainly won't be the case.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Mike Friedman. He's made a new film called Critical Mass, and it's not a pretty picture. Well, several of your interview subjects have been on Radio EcoShock, including Robert Rapier, Bill Reese, Richard Heinberg, and John Michael Greer. But you have Bill Reese, the global footprint guy, and zoologist Desmond Morris, the author of The Naked Ape, talking about population instead of sustainability. Or are they really the same subject?
I don't think it needs to be argued that the number of people alive on the planet is uniquely linked to whether or not the society in which those people live is sustainable. I think the idea that humans exist somehow separate from an impact on nature and the bounds of the laws of physics and inertia and sustainability, I don't need to speak to that more than it has been so far. I avoid using the word sustainability in my day-to-day life because I believe it's wildly overused. I was browsing the internet the other day and I saw a website for a company that was offering sustainable design. So I have no idea what the hell they were selling. And I think it's a wildly overused and washed out term. I think, as Albert Bartlett, in his excellent, if chilling, lecture that is viewable for free on YouTube, said about population growth, take a 0.1% increase in human population and extrapolate it indefinitely, and you'll see that it does eventually reach a point where it's unsustainable. Unsustainable in the sense that it cannot be sustained further. So whatever it is, whether it's 5 trillion people eating beans or it's 50 people eating tremendous amounts, you know, consumption and population are, as Bob Engelman from the World Watch Institute says, two sides of the same rectangle. You need both of them to calculate the contents, the volume, the area of that rectangle. Bill Reese and Desmond Morris both are intimately familiar with what we've been through in terms of population growth, and they're also very well-versed in what the future looks like. Both of them are very conscious about environmental matters. In an aside during his interview, Desmond told me that he was present at the original meeting of what eventually became the World Wildlife Fund. And he angered the original founder because he suggested that if they really wanted to conserve the animal species of the planet, that they should put their panda motif on a series of condoms and give them out for free. And that made the guy angry, and then apparently Desmond bumped into him 25 years later, and the guy said, actually, you were right. Now, to be clear, I don't advocate anything remotely control-based in terms of the population picture going forward. I'm not in favor of coercion. I'm not largely, to be honest, in favor of most centralized, dominator, top-down, dictatorial methods of governing societies or groups. And I don't think that application of more exaggerated methods in that vein are going to solve the problems that have largely been created by exactly those methods to begin with. I think that it's evident the population is intimately connected to sustainability. I don't think that a human population that grows indefinitely would be sustainable. I also don't necessarily think that we have a population that will grow indefinitely. But the question is, let's say we level off at 10 or 11 billion. What kind of lifestyle will be sustainable then? And then what about if the numbers begin to decline? What type of society would be sustainable then? One of the great challenges going forward now, as we see playing out the economic crises in Europe and the ongoing stagnation in Japan and in the United States, is that we have a structural political and economic framework to our societies that demands growth, that requires it, because all of our models, all of our methods are predicated on the idea that there's going to be more throughput, more people, more goods, and more consumption year on year. And when that is not present, our economics fails to explain what is happening. And this is exactly what we're seeing around the world right now in those countries that are either experiencing stagnant economic growth or leveled off or decreasing population. So the question is not only, can we increase indefinitely? I don't think we can, and I also don't think we will. And the question isn't, is population at a high level sustainable? A deeper question is, how can we reorganize and redesign our social, political, and economic systems to accurately meet and reflect and fulfill the real needs of human beings? It's too easy to point at a spreadsheet and talk about what growth is and what it does. It's much harder to see human beings as holistic, living creatures that have emotional and psychological needs as well as their physical needs. And this, I think, is one of the great worries in not only the current political and economic sectors, but also in the environmental movement. The environmental movement has traditionally emphasized the kind of the accounting tools of sustainability. How much water use, how much pollution, how much food do we need? But as Calhoun himself said, we need to put the mental back in environmental. You know, humans have deeper needs and a more meaningful purpose in life than merely finding enough rice to eat for the day and having enough water. And so we shouldn't simply think about the bare bones of supplying survival. We need to think about what it will mean to ensure that every person born on this beautiful planet of ours has a full, meaningful life. And that's the real challenge, whether population is going up, whether it's stabilizing or whether it's declining, is being willing to reassess and reorganize all of our assumptions, all of our algorithms and spreadsheets, all of our models for planning and molding society based purely on the quality of the life experience for every person alive.
You know, I love what you've just said, and I think my listeners are going to really appreciate it. I have to ask you, in your promo clips, I didn't see anything about that other big threat, global climate disruption. Did you cover that as well?
We don't discuss climate change in the film for several reasons. First of all, because it's such a tremendous topic that we've already covered in so many films by so many different filmmakers that it was really difficult to find something to say. And this led me to the second point, which is that in thinking about how to talk about the interplay between people and the climate, unfortunately, the majority of that discourse is predicated on exactly the type of accounting that I was discussing just now, in the sense that they have calculated how much CO2 a human releases versus any other animal. They've calculated the savings to global CO2 emissions if people have only two children as opposed to three. They've also calculated that contraception is, in a dollar way, better value for money than renewable energy. But all of these things speak to exactly the system of physical material accounting that, as I just mentioned, I don't fully believe accurately represents what humans need or want in life. And the third reason is that I do feel, and this is a personal thing, I do feel that the environmental movement in the past 15 years has become almost wholesale the climate change movement. And I think that that's a real shame, because I think that I don't know old school because I'm not that old, so I don't know necessarily that it was this way in the past, but the way that environmentalism occurs to me, which is to protect what you see around you from the things that threaten it, is a much more local, community-based approach to stewardship. And we seem now to have global environmental NGOs with corporate mission statements and sponsors, and they have board meetings and the rest of it. And they have expense accounts, and they travel, and they go to symposiums, and they talk to politicians. But on the ground, there's so much to be done to preserve our forests, to preserve our water, to preserve our land, to make sure that the air that we breathe is clean, to make sure that what falls out of the sky isn't laced with something that got put up miles away. There's so much to be done that in itself, if it was addressed at the local community level, would have a knock-on effect at the global level, including carbon emissions, that I didn't feel that this film could bring in the climate change thread in a way that would, A, be new, B, be relevant to the thrust of what we were saying in the film, and C, be productive to the aim that I had for the movie, which is to invite further discussion of the role of human numbers and human consumption on our impact on the planet and on our psychology, and also to invite further study on how we can change and help each other and be more compassionate.
So what do you need now, Mike Friedman, to get this movie out there?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Alex. We've completed the film. We've previewed it at a couple of festivals. The reception has been uniformly positive, which is very encouraging. We've had favorable comments from several very well-placed individuals, and we've had offers of distribution as well for DVD and theatrical in Italy, for DVD in the UK, and we have an offer of a digital partnership here in the US, and I'm also currently on my way to Los Angeles to take a couple more meetings with distributors there. Now, the stumbling block we have is that in the film we use some archive footage. So footage that we sourced from the 1960s, the 1950s, the 1980s. And the companies that supply this footage don't offer it as a pro bono charity service for indie filmmakers, unfortunately. So we're currently running an Indiegogo campaign to raise the money we need to clear the archive footage so that we can begin signing the distribution offers that we have, which will bring the film out in Italy, the UK, and the US, and will allow us the flexibility we need to take advantage of further offers as they arise in other territories. And that Indiegogo campaign is at indiegogo.com/criticalmass. And there's obviously more information on our website, which is criticalmassfilm.com. And we're hoping that we can raise at least $30,000. And if we can do that, I'm in a very strong position to talk to these archive footage guys and get the clearances we need, which only require money. The permission is not a problem. It's the money. And then hopefully we can roll out the film.
And that's not a lot of money. You know, 30,000 of us with a buck each, and you're on your way, and we'll all be a lot smarter. We've been talking with Mike Friedman. His new movie, now in the final stages, getting ready for release, is Critical Mass. Stay tuned at criticalmassfilm.com. Thank you for doing this, Mike.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Mother Nature is not going to negotiate, and when we don't have the oil, we're going to be forced to the negotiating table one way or the other.
What we want to achieve is decline in human civilization in the early to middle decades of the century, we are right on track.
Dr. Calhoun, as a human being, after going through this experiment, what goes through your mind? Are you worried about the future of mankind?
The fact is that population growth ultimately has such a huge impact that no matter how much I recycle my waste, it isn't going to really affect a planet which sees over 200,000 more people every day. Every day. Someone once said, oh, we go to another planet. Every day you'd have to get 200,000 people into the spaceship, send them off to another planet.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and I want to direct this question to Bill McKibben. A lot of my listeners are in the United States. They're in San Francisco, they're in Florida, they're in New England. Why should they care at all? Why should they be listening to this? Why should they care about what's happening up in northern Canada somewhere?
You know, they don't call it global warming for nothing. This is the first issue we've ever had that really does require the entire world to try and come to terms with something. You know, we can have a long, actually not so much anymore, but there was sort of a debate about, say, whether secondhand smoke was as dangerous as smoking cigarettes yourself or whatever. But there's absolutely no debate about whether secondhand carbon is as dangerous. I mean, you burn tar sands oil in China or you burn it in Alberta, burn it anyplace else, it has exactly the same effect on the climate. And there are now people in every corner of the world feeling the effects. Where I live in Vermont is as bucolic and beautiful as parts of British Columbia. But last year we had the biggest rainstorm that we've ever had, and it just about tore the place apart. We've lost 500 miles of state highway and 15 bridges, and there were 9 towns cut off from the rest of the town next to mine. They were airdropping food in via helicopter. And, you know, I'm happy to be here tonight, but I confess I've got one eye on the weather report, because there's another monster hurricane now coming up the east coast of the United States, and the ocean temperature off New England is 5 degrees warmer than normal. It's the highest ocean temperatures ever, which means that that hurricane will be able to suck up incredible amounts of moisture. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold, and it'll dump it someplace, if not on Vermont, then on New Hampshire or on New Jersey or on New Brunswick or someplace along that route. And it's a nice idea that we should just take care of our own places, you know. And we should take care of our own places, and we should make them as good as we can and build as solid communities as we can. And we're going to have to, because we have to adapt to that which we can't prevent, you know. We've been busy building much longer bridges in Vermont so they won't wash away next time, and so on and so forth. But remember what I told you about, we've raised temperature 1 degree and we're going to do it 5 degrees unless we stop. You have to adapt to that which you can't prevent, but even more, you've got to prevent that to which no one can adapt. And that's just the place where we are right now. The tar sands, at least the latest data I saw from Jim Hansen, I said, if you could burn all the economically recoverable oil up there, that would be more carbon than humans have yet burned in all the other things that they've burned, okay? There's a lot of stuff. Now, exactly the same thing is true of huge coal mines in Australia and huge fracking fields in the eastern United States and tar sands in Venezuela. It's not the only place in the world we can do this, but we no longer have any margin. We just melted the Arctic, okay? So we've got to stop all these places from going on. It is a bad sign when you eliminate one of the major physical features on the Earth, and it might be the sort of definition of a wake-up call, you know, to watch the Arctic melt. The next few years are just a really interesting test as to whether the big brain was a smart adaptation or not, whether it's connected to a big enough heart to kind of get us out of the trouble that we've gotten into, and that's what we'll find out.
Radio EcoShock.
I'm from northeastern British Columbia, Treaty 8 country. My land is, you know, where the mountains meet the plains. It's a beautiful country.
What's happening to us is a good example of what's happening globally. What I hope to learn from the Maori is how their people have used the law and blended it with their own law.
So I see this as the second wave of colonization for us. But this time it's colonization by capital. And capital doesn't have borders.
Almost every house, at least every other house, has probably had someone with cancer or someone in their family with major birth defects.
I don't care what we get out of it. I don't want that on our land.
It looks like flaring in the night sky all over your territory. It looks like big trucks with big burly men. A highly profitable boom and bust type economy has intrinsic difficulties, especially when sitting on top of 100 years of not so healthy cultural interactions, alcoholism, sexual abuse, physical abuse, endemic violence, both in the community around us and within our own family.
Children have a predisposition and amplified suffering as a result of exposure to toxics.
As you know from my face, I think I'm one of the few people in Canada that can say I've had my lips sewn together.
You've just heard clips from the film Fractured Land by Damian Gillies. I featured native lead of Caleb Ben from the Athabascan Chipewyan First Nation in the far northeastern corner of Canada's province of British Columbia. Caleb is articling as a law student, but now seeing the complete failure of the law and the Canadian government to protect his land, he's wondering if becoming a lawyer is a mistake. Many of his people are prepared to break the law to stop the Northern Gateway Pipeline, another big gas pipeline up there, and the desecration of their land by the world's largest fracking operation. For the Aboriginal people, fracking is just the latest invasion. Their lands were grabbed for fur, gold, and logging. Their children were taken away to be trained as little white people in residential schools. Their language was forbidden. Abuse was commonplace. I recorded Caleb Ben speaking in Burnaby, Canada, on October 25, 2012, at an anti-pipeline presentation with 350.org founder Bill McKibben and Council of Canadians founder Maude Barlow, plus Vancouver First Nations speaker Reuben George. Here is Caleb Ben.
I'm from about 2,000 kilometers that way. We have the dubious distinction of being the site of the world's largest frack last year. And we produce a third of the power in these lights. We produce a sizable portion of the coal that comes out of the port at Roberts Bank. We produce a lot of revenue for this province. And I would bet not many of you guys have been up there. I would bet that not many of you guys have traveled that part of our province. But the province and the piece of land that I come from, that my family's come from, has given a great deal to this collective we call British Columbia. And I don't think that a lot of people really appreciate that until you go up, until you see the size of what it is that I'm engaged in, the size of what it is that my family has fought for, and the size of the things that we fight for. Yeah, I hope that you can understand that my world is a little bit different, far away from this world where I've gone to school, because there's no law schools up there. So this is a series of slides as of 2005, just showing my territories. My father's nation, the Etchodene, are the nation up top, the little red dot. My mother's nation, the Dunizo and the Cree, are the little nation down in the kind of the bottom right here. So this is a series of slides depicting aspects of the oil and gas industry in my territory. These are petroleum development roads. This doesn't include Forest Service roads. This doesn't include anything major. This is just stuff built to access petroleum. I think we went through facilities and well sites there. The territory I'm from has massive oil and gas development, both conventional and unconventional. These are seismic lines, and of course you need seismic to identify the subsurface structures and figure out what exactly the deal is, to put your wells appropriately, particularly for unconventional gas. Unconventional gas, you need to have 3D seismic to have very detailed maps. This is one vision of my territory, you know, and it's not really to scale in some ways, but it depicts, I think, the intensity and the scope of the territory I'm in. This is high-volume slick water hydraulic fracturing. This is pre-horizontal drilling. This is my territory before the Barnett Shale technology got perfected and Halliburton and Schlumberger figured out how to do this stuff. This is just a historical trajectory of wells drilled in my territory. You kind of see the ramp up and the consistent pattern we see with unconventional resource development and non-renewables. And that's been something that my family, both my grandfathers were chiefs, as was my mother. And my dad was deeply involved in Treaty 8 Tribal Association, the constitutional debates. And so we've lived with this pattern like for our whole lives. And that's come to typify my existence and one of the reasons I went to law school. This is a map of my father's territory, the Etchodeni territory, up in the top corner there. And you'll see kind of some, the blue bits are 3D seismic programs. They'd be big enough to cover Burnaby, probably. They're very large. They cut 3-meter swaths through the bush, put dynamite down these little holes, detonate them, have hydrophones that pick up the sounds and then process it down and create very detailed maps. But this is what it looked like as development came. Next slide, please. And then this is development this last year and a half ago. And this is what comes. This is the nature of unconventional energy. This is, in this context, this is the nature of Horn River development and Horn River natural gas. But you see this process and these dynamics all over. There's a couple interesting points about the slide above me. One, you can see kind of where the pipeline infrastructure then facilitates the well site extractions. The same with the mining. You need the pipelines, as Maud said so eloquently. I mean, they're the veins, they're the arteries of these developments. And so we understood very early and very in a very profound way, the importance of those pieces of infrastructure and how they fed together. The point I want to end in is that the gas that comes from my territory goes over the tar sands and goes to market. The associated products, so the sulfur and the condensate's what's used to dilute the bitumen that comes out of the tar sands. So when we talk about unconventional resource development, the world's most energy-intensive gas comes out of my territory and goes over to the Athabasca Chip, and it takes out the world's most energy-intensive oil. And, you know, I don't want to end on a negative note. I turned 31 yesterday, and I want to be positive as I enter this new phase of my life. But, but that's a tough one to swallow because Maud mentioned treaty rights, and that's accurate, but there's also treaty responsibilities. And I think you should recognize that you're treaty members, too. You know, my people agreed by Treaty 8 in 1899 to share our territory with you, but that made both of us in a relationship. And the relationship I have to my land and my people compels me to question when things come out of my land and go to other people's land and destroy theirs. And the CO2 that comes out of these energy developments has a consequence globally. And that, for me, is the more appropriate way to construct these dialogues and understand that our responsibility as a collective is to engage on these issues. I mean, whether or not you share my perspective, which is why I acknowledged industry and government, you know, at least we can dialogue on that. And so I'll end with this. You know, in my territory right now, this week, we're fighting large-scale water licenses. The first of their kind, they're built specifically for fracturing, and they're built to facilitate certain fields that we feel should be developed. And we have exhausted every legal remedy we can. We've exhausted negotiations. We've had bad faith negotiations on the part of the province consistently. The treaty hasn't been implemented appropriately in 111 years. And it's at a point where I regret going into a profession where I'm compelled to follow the law. And that's really hard for me, my family, and my people. And so I'd ask you guys, if you don't agree with my politics and my perspective and my vision of what this stuff actually is, at least bear witness to what's happening up there. If you can't stand with me, bear witness to what's happening. Because what's happening here and whether or not we solve these questions of resource extraction and equitability in these two kind of fighting cultures, this is a world issue. You know, it happens on gas, it happens on oil, it happens on water. And in my territory, they came for the furs, they came for the gold, they came for the forest, they came for the coal, they came for the wind, they came for the children. My father went to residential school. They came for the gas, they came to suck the lifeblood of Mother Earth, and they came for the water. And they used the water to crack the land even further. And with respect, I can't be a part of that, and I hope you can't either. But if you can, at least bear witness to what happens, because this is our collective, this is our like vision of our culture standing together and creating something called Canada, British Columbia, and people in general. So with that, I'll end again acknowledging all of you for coming and giving me a moment to speak. Cheers.
Find more on the upcoming Damian Gillies film Fractured Land at fracturedland.com. In my blog at ecoshock.info, I've got links to a Vimeo clip from the movie, including Josh Fox, director of Gasland, Naomi Klein, author and syndicated journalist, Thomas Mulcair, the leader of the NDP, Canada's official opposition, and many more. Fracking is right up there with the tar sands. You know that. It's a dirty technology that poisons the land while emitting large amounts of greenhouse gases, especially methane. For everybody concerned about fracking, Canada is a big part of the picture. But you can win. Here is what happened in one of Canada's biggest provinces, Quebec.
The industry had hired some of the best-known Quebec figures. I mean, the former head of Hydro-Quebec was there, shilling for the gas companies in front of the cameras. One of his main arguments was, mais le Québec est en train de prendre du retard. Quebec is falling behind. And the average Quebecer said, tell it to somebody else. We see what this is causing. These wells are leaking. This is going to ruin the groundwater. My family's been on this farm for centuries. Get out. And that's what happened. The Quebec public stood up and threw them out. And they haven't come back.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Maud Barlow was a key speaker at the October panel against the tar sands, the pipeline delivering tarry bitumen across the wilderness, and supertankers in the dangerous seas off the west coast of Canada. Barlow is the national chairperson of the Council of Canadians, co-founder of the World Water Rights Group Blue Planet Project, a founding member of the San Francisco-based International Forum on Globalization, and a counselor with the Hamburg-based World Future Council. Barlow has written more than a dozen books. Now she's going to lay out the dangers of the tar sands, linked up to the oily politics as Canada leads the world into climate catastrophe. Here is Maud Barlow, recorded in Vancouver, October 25th, by Radio EcoShock.
I'm just going to remind us what we're dealing with here, and I know a lot of people in this room know a lot of stats, but there may be people for whom some of this is new, so I'm just going to remind us of a few things, and Caleb has, of course, started that. In the tar sands, we're now up to close to 2 million barrels a day now being produced, and this is the dirtiest oil on Earth. We need to understand and remember that this is not conventional oil. At the moment, the area being exploited, producing this oil, is bigger than Scotland and releases amazing amounts of greenhouse gas emissions, way more, of course, than conventional oil. In fact, if Alberta were a country, it would have the highest per capita carbon footprint of any country in the world. James Hansen says that if the Alberta tar sands are allowed to continue to grow, it's game over for the climate. This is the amazing scientist from NASA. There are 170 square kilometers of toxic lakes that are filled with water that's been used in the production of the tar sands that are so toxic, when the birds land on them, they die, so they have to keep shooting bullet-sounding warnings to the birds 24/7. And 11 million liters of toxic water leak into from these lakes every single day into the groundwater and find their way into the Athabasca. They are making the land and the water and the wildlife and the people sick. That's not enough for them. They are now planning an expansion of $40 billion over the next 5 years and the building of 14,000 new kilometers of new pipelines, which will add 3.1 million barrels of oil bitumen a day to be produced. That's on top of the almost 2 million now. To send to pipelines all over the world or to export the bitumen all over the world through pipelines. So we need to understand that there is a plan to increase the tar sands 4 to 5 fold over the next 5 years, and the fight that we're putting up here against the pipelines takes an urgency when we understand what these plans are about. You know well, of course, that we're talking about the Northern Gateway, which would, if built, traverse 800 rivers and streams and have, for the first time, 220 super tankers moving through the Great Bear Sea. Some of these tankers would be as long as the Empire State Building is high, and many of them would carry more oil than the Exxon Valdez carried. Then, of course, we have Kinder Morgan and the plan to twin Kinder Morgan, which traverses 98 streams and rivers and goes through Jasper Parks. The expansion would add at least 360 supertankers to Burrard Inlet. I don't think we should forget, and I think it's very important that we put these all together, that the Pacific Trails, because I think we need to think about the bitumen and the fracking pipelines together. There are seven projects in the northern area around new pipelines and liquefied gas terminals to take fracked gas from northeastern British Columbia and Alberta and to move it to tankers as well to be exported away. And then, of course, there are the myriad of other pipelines. There's the Keystone, and that fight is still going on. There were two people sitting in trees that would not come down, and as of today, two more slipped past the police, the private security forces of the company, and are now joining the two people in the trees in Texas. They're amazing. They put their lives on the line, their livelihoods. And I think when we are successful in stopping these pipelines here in British Columbia, there is already talk of an eastern pipeline. So we're going to see a struggle on the East Coast, both of Canada, through Canada and the United States, around these pipelines. I think it's very important for us to put all of this together and to understand that British Columbia is becoming Canada's carbon corridor, and understand what between the federal government and the provincial government and these big corporations have planned a very destructive future for this province. It's the perfect storm to take this dirty bitumen, this fracked gas, these tankers into some of the roughest waters in the world and expect somehow that this will not devastate this province. It's just simply a pipe dream, not our pipe dream, their pipe dream. Spills. In 2011, the federal regulator did a study and said there were gaps and deficiencies in two-thirds of Canada's pipelines. Alberta has had over 6,500 spills in the last 20 years, Alberta alone, and there have been 400 spills in Canada's waterways, oil spills in Canada's waterways, just in the years between 2007 and 2009. Kinder Morgan alone has had 78 spills in its history. So this notion that they can build a kinder, happier pipeline and that we're just being silly remembering the past is absolutely false. But I think it's important for us to remember, someone pointed it out last night, it's something that Bill always says as well, that even if they successfully take this bitumen through pipelines and by tanker and there by miracle isn't a spill here, you're still creating environmental disaster somewhere else in the world when it's used. Now, I want to put this against a larger backdrop because I want us to understand the federal government's role. I know that in British Columbia you tend to think about the provincial government a lot, but I think we need to think about what the Harper government is doing here and how it's impacting what's happening. I believe Stephen Harper has a plan. I think he's very, very clear in what he wants to do. He wants to make Canada an energy superpower. He wants us to become one of the economic superpowers of the world, and the way he's going to do it is to open up for total and complete unregulated exploitation, all of our energy, all of our minerals, our forests, our fish, probably our water eventually, and anything else anyone can get their hands on. So he has eviscerated or outright killed all sorts of programs, fired scientists in Environment Canada, the Department of Ocean and Fisheries and Oceans. In fact, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans recently said that they've laid off so many habitat inspectors that they admit they cannot do the proper assessment of the Northern Gateway. They've gutted natural resources. They've gutted Parks Canada. They actually cannot protect our parks anymore. There are not enough personnel. They killed the air pollution monitoring team, among many other scientific centers. And this means that we no longer have the facility at the federal level to even undertake scientific research on what kind of pollutants are coming out of the tar sands or anywhere else. And they gutted the Fisheries Act, which is now just a shadow of its former self. They killed the environmental assessment process and have really limited the kinds of interventions we can make. And in the omnibus bill, they just gutted the Navigable Waters Protection Act and basically are saying that pipelines are exempted from the act and can cross any of the 32,000 lakes in our country unimpeded. So we need to understand that this has been done very carefully, very deliberately. There was a former finance minister from New Zealand. His name was Roger Douglas. And when Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan first brought in this massive deregulation around the world, he thought it was great and brought it to New Zealand. And he used to go around giving a speech to right-wing governments, telling them how to do things if they happen to get into power. Because he said if the public finds out what you're really about, you might not get a second term. So we used to say, hit them hard, hit them fast, hit them all at once. You think that's bad? Well, I'm just going to hit you with this. At the same time, and this must not escape below our radar screen, he is signing trade agreements that are a new and dangerous breed of trade agreements that are all about locking in our resources to corporations from other countries in a permanent way. He's got the Canada-European Union, CETA, Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, which is going to give European corporations the right to have to sue if any future government changes any rules and regulations, brings any environmental regulations in. We have NAFTA still with the investor state there, investor state provision where we have a legal opinion that says that if the Alberta government were to come to its senses and bring in legislation to protect its water, the corporations would all have to obey it, but the American corporations operating in the tar sands could sue for billions of dollars in compensation because their right to profit, this is what it's called, has been interrupted. And we now actually have cases where companies are actually claiming the actual water rights, not just financial compensation for changing the rules, but actual water rights. A company named Abitibi Bowater, a big pulp and paper company from the U.S., operated in Newfoundland for many years and went bankrupt 4 years ago and left and turned around. Not only did they leave jobs and pensions behind with people just devastated, they turned around and demanded compensation for the water rights that they left behind. Now, the premier at the time was Danny Williams, and as you can imagine, he kind of told the company where they could put that idea. So they turned to Chapter 11 of NAFTA and sued the Canadian government. Without fighting for Newfoundland, the Harper government turned around and gave them $130 million, which is basically setting a precedent in this country and actually around the world, because these trade agreements do ratchet the bar up continually, you know, on behalf of each other. And so now we have a case where corporations can actually claim the actual water that they need for their operations in another country. Most recently, we're deeply concerned about the China, Canada Foreign Investment Protection and Promotion Act. These FIPAs, there are many, many of them. There's over 2,600 of them around the world, and this is where governments one-on-one make an agreement with another government that each one will protect its corporate interests in the other country. But the dangerous new thing about this one is that this is going to protect Chinese government-backed corporations, such as the state-owned energy company that wants to buy Nexen. So now here's the scenario, and here's exactly how it would work. And by the way, it's not to go to a vote, and there's no debate in the House of Commons. It becomes the law November 1st if we're not able to find a way to stop it. Here's how it would work. If the FIPA passes and it's law, 31 years it's in existence, that's the soonest that you could break it. CNOOC is given, the Chinese-owned state company is given the right to go ahead and buy Nexen. It buys it on the understanding that there are pipelines coming, all right, because that's the understanding. I just came from Fort McMurray. Everybody there is quite sure it's going to happen. Nobody there has the confidence we have that it's not. A new government comes in British Columbia, says we're canceling the pipelines, and this company can sue, this state-backed company can sue for billions of dollars of lost future revenue because we have broken, clearly broken, an international treaty. That's how that would work. And we are flooding our MPs' offices and MLAs' offices with notices, with concern, please, please keep it up if you've been part of that fight. We are actually calling on Premier Clark in this province and other provinces as well, but I think it's particularly important here to actually seek an injunction to stop this process if the government doesn't back down, because actually what they're doing is against the law. They're entering territory that actually belongs to the provincial jurisdiction. So let's be really clear with what we're dealing here. With more than two-thirds of the tar sands production is owned by foreign corporations, all right? So we now have a government in Ottawa that is gutting our environmental regulations as fast as he can, every single one of them, leaving us without tools to fight against this. And at the same time, he's handing over rights, new rights to corporations through these trade agreements, basically to serve the interests of foreign energy corporations. I mean, that is the stark, cold reality of what we're dealing with. He's not only doing that, but through trade agreements, he's actually binding the hands of the provinces, because the European agreement binds provinces and municipalities for the first time. And he's starving municipalities of funding. And then anybody wants to bring in new infrastructure, he says, yeah, well, you've got to go to a public-private partnership. So he, bit by bit by bit, we're losing the tools that we have had previously to fight this kind of assault. So what has become very, very clear to me is that we have to build a movement. We have to build a resistance unlike anything we have seen in this country before. We have to bridge all the pipeline fights. We cannot think of Kinder Morgan separately from Gateway, separately from Pacific, separately from Keystone, separately even from proposed pipelines in the future. I mean, people don't know there's already Alberta bitumen being refined in 17 refineries on the American side of the Great Lakes. I mean, it's already happening. We have to stop. We have to come together and stop these pipelines. We have to support, and this is very, very, very important. We have to not only support but recognize the incredible leadership of the First Nations communities in this country who are on the front lines of these assaults. And not just on energy, but it's very important. It's not just that they've got this courage, but they still have treaty rights. They have governance structures that we need. I mean, this is one of the last areas that we can go to really stand up to these energy companies and these governments, and it's incredibly important that we understand that. And that's why it was such an honor to stand with Athabasca and Chipewyan First Nation in Fort McMurray a couple of days ago to be there when this challenge was launched. And sad for me to see how little support there was in the community. I talked about it to taxi drivers and people in restaurants, and they would say they deeply understand at a personal level, but boy, is there ever a lot of money to be made in this. People admit it. These are jobs. And, of course, what worries me is that whatever's going to make people sick in Fort Chipewyan is also going to make the children of the workers sick. I mean, it's not like it suddenly stops at a particular place. This is a poisoned atmosphere, and it's growing in its poison, and it's going to affect everyone eventually. So we have to say, come together, and we have to say that the pipelines are the bloodlines of the tar sands. And this is the most important thing for us to get into our heads. If we don't stop the pipelines, we're going to have a very difficult time stopping the expansion of the tar sands. Because then it's like the energy companies are directing energy policy in Canada. You build the pipelines, they have to be filled. They cost so much to build, you have to fill them. And so it goes. So we have to say that the most important thing that we can do now is to stand with the 50 municipalities, the 132 First Nations peoples in this province, and that's just this province alone, who have said, we have taken a complete stand. They have said, and we need to stand with them, and we need to organize like we haven't organized before, in standing up and saying to these transnational energy companies and the federal government under Stephen Harper and the provincial government under Christy Clark, whose demands are an insult, an absolute insult in terms of, okay, it's all right if you pay us, and you can do this damage to our land if you pay us. We have to stand up, and we have to say with these communities where these pipelines are coming through, including Burnaby, you shall not pass. Thank you.
That was Maud Barlow speaking at one of six Save Our Coast rallies, this one in a suburb of Vancouver, where one proposed tar sands pipeline will feed giant tankers sailing out of the world-renowned harbor with its parks and beaches. You can download a copy of this speech from the Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. We're out of time. Thank you to all those who donated to keep Radio EcoShock alive. Join us next week.